This episode is brought to you by Just Egg. It's a better egg made from plants. Bring more customers in your doors with Just Egg. Start with a free sample at ju.st/hrn.
This episode is brought to you by The Great Grow Along. Sign up at greatgrowalong.com.
Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday from whenever to whenever. I'm on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. We got Nastasia the Hammer Lopez up in Connecticut on the Long Island Sound. How you doing, Stas?
Good.
Good. We got Matt in the Rhode Island booth. Matt, how you doing?
Doing great.
We got John, who's in East. You're in Lyme right now, right? You're in Lyme,
correct.
Connecticut. So we're a New England heavy show today, but I'm going to bring it back to New York because we have everybody's favorite Cooking Issues guest, Peter Kim. How you doing, Peter?
Punching bag.
Everyone's favorite. Well, yeah. He's not a punching
bag. Once a punching
anymore.
Bag, always a punching bag.
No, here's the thing. So, Peter Kim, you're in Brooklyn right now, right?
Yep.
And since we haven't had you on since the pandemic, so when the pandemic started, the last time we had Peter on the show, there was not a pandemic yet, and we were furiously at the Museum of Food and Drink trying to open African/American, which is our exhibition at the museum on kind of the contributions, both known and unknown, of Black folk to American foodways, and then the whole world fell apart. Peter's plan, right? Peter, right or wrong, was to you were going to open the exhibition, and then you're moving away from the museum to go become the head of the food program there at Pinterest. But you had like timed it so that like you like, I've worked for years, I'm going to get this exhibition open, we're going to do it, and then the whole bottom kind of fell out of the world, right?
Yeah. So instead, Jean and I were like duct taping up like boxes in front of the quilt to keep the sunlight from making it fade, and like we were like turbo trying to like basically we were like, we don't know when somebody's going to be able to come back in this room again, and so we're going to basically do whatever we can to like preserve this thing. As far as I know, I mean, it's more or less like we left it, isn't it, Jean?
I think more stuff has been stacked in there because Africa Center needed some of the other space, and the pallets of shoebox lunches came, or you know, lunch boxes came.
Oh my God! What? That was such a crazy time.
Yeah. Crazy is another word for bad, right?
When's it opening? Like, when's it actually going to open?
Oh, geez, Stas. Geez, Luis.
Oh, we really, you don't know.
Well, look, a lot of things have to happen for it to open, and you know, I'm only one person, so it's, you know.
I was just saying, like, ballpark.
Oh, next year.
2022?
Yeah, that's that's the year that comes after 2021.
Hey, Jesus.
Yeah, because the problem is that like everything has to work for everybody, for all the stakeholders, and the way that the space. So we're really in the weeds on stuff that half the people listening probably have no idea what we're talking about. The Museum of Food and Drink, Peter was the founding whatever. He started the museum's actual programming. Like, I had this idea many years ago. I tried to start it. I failed. Nastasia and I did a fundraiser where we met Peter. Peter quit. This is the short story. Peter quit his job as a white shoe. But white shoe? Who the hell wears white shoes at a white shoe law firm? What is that? What is
Nobody.
White shoe?
What no,
the
hell is
it?
Yeah.
Why is it called
misnomer.
That?
Misnomer. I don't
yeah.
know.
It's crazy, right? I mean, like, if you wore a white shoe to work, people would be like, the hell, right?
Right.
Yeah. So he's at this white shoe law firm. And we'll get into this later, because it's well known that, like, being a lawyer was kind of like, you didn't really want to be a lawyer, right? That was to please your parents.
I was interested in studying the law and being a lawyer, maybe just not working at a firm like that. But, you know, it was good to cut your teeth at a corporate firm like that to kind of understand that world too.
Yeah. And so he's like, I'm going to quit my job and you know, I'm going to actually make this museum happen, which is what he did. And we, Nastassi and I both told him not to do it because, you know, we were like, we don't know, is it going to work? Boop, beep, boop, boop. And, you know, also, you weren't so happy on the home front back in Illinois with your parents, where I guess they weren't in Illinois at that time. But you know what I mean? Like, it was, yeah, it was a source of problems, let's say.
Yes, my dad and I were not on good terms for a few years there.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's another story.
So anyway, so like he does this, he makes it happen, the museum. And then we do the African-American exhibit where it was like, it was supposed to be, it's going to be, you know, great. But anyway, so he negotiated with this place called the Africa Center, which is where the exhibit's going to be. And, you know, we could have, actually, Peter, we should have you back on sometime just to talk about, now that, you know, you've kind of like put a cap on that portion of your career, of what it's like to start something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, because it's just a nutty, I mean, it's just a nutty thing that you had to do, like from passing out on a you know, cherry picker at 3 a.m. trying to like hang lights to, you know, negotiating with people, because everyone who tries to, and wow.
Whoa.
John's dog doesn't like putting things up at 2 a.m. Anyway, so.
Yeah, no, I mean, look, well, first of all, I would be remiss to not say there were a lot of other people who worked on this along, you know, with me. But yes.
I'm not talking to them right now.
Yes. I would say, yes, it's a lot of self-flagellation to get something like this off the ground. Starting up anything, anybody who started a business knows it's hard. I'd say starting a nonprofit is another level of interestingness, and then starting a nonprofit museum that requires like a brick and mortar presence is another level of fun.
Well, I think it's like also like, you know, it's a brick and mortar thing, but it's also a creative endeavor. And I think, right, you know, the corners that you have to cut and the decisions that you have to make on the fly and then people hold you to later are just crazy. This is why criticism in general I find so kind of upsetting. Because it's kind of like, I mean, look, a consumer of a museum event, a consumer of a drink or a dish or of a podcast, they shouldn't have to care. In fact, specifically, you know, I tell myself this all the time, nobody cares like what your problems are. That's not what's important. Like, you're right, asking their time or their money. And so you owe everything to them and they owe nothing to you. It's kind of like being a parent. Like, you owe everything to your kids and they don't really owe anything to you.
And that's why you just take all the problems and you just push them down deep inside. Just keep pushing. Yeah. That's my advice.
Let the hate flow. Yeah, but it does, like, but when critics, you know, don't kind of give any credit at all for the how hard it is to make anything happen, it kind of ticks me a little bit. But anyway, so that said, back to Nastassia, we can't, the fact that we're in a space at the Africa Center means that we cannot open unless we're at full capacity. We can't guarantee full capacity until 2022 because it takes X number of months to open something, to decide you're going to open it. So the CDC only yesterday came out and said that we might be back to normal by the end of the year, and it's just not enough time to flip all of the switches. So there you have it.
I see.
And that's how stuff works when you're a scrappy startup. Anyway, so Peter went on to do Pinterest, but the reason we're having him on the show now is he is the host of his own hit podcast, Counter Jam. You want to talk to us about it?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, yeah, podcast, Counter Jam.
On Food 52 Network, by the way.
Yep, it's on the Food 52 Podcast Network, and it's a show that looks at culture through food and music. And so the basic gist of it is every episode takes on one cultural identity that could be something like Korean-American cultural identity, or it might even be a place, so like New York City. And then I think of it as sort of presenting various data points. So you're just showing the perspectives of two or three people from that community and then also playing music that has been created by a couple artists from that community as well. And so, yeah, I mean, it's been a lot of fun to put together, and I think I realized at a certain point there weren't a lot of food and music podcasts out there, or actually really any music podcast that actually play music. And I know why. It's because legally it is a pain in the butt to play music on a podcast. And then I did what, of course, what I do, and I just took on the sort of masochistic task of going through, like, getting licensing for all the music and negotiating each individual song.
Oh, so you don't have, like, a blanket BMI ASCAP license? You have to go and, like, individually do each song?
Yeah, yeah. So that's the thing about podcasting. It doesn't work with those, like, BMI ASCAP licenses because the shows are downloaded. And so...
They haven't figured this out yet?
No. And so it's a known thing in the podcasting world. So when you hear music on a podcast, either A, they're doing it just hoping that they won't get busted or that they can do a fair use defense, or they're doing what I do, which is tracking down the licensing. And it's not even just one license. Usually every song is owned by at least two entities and sometimes three or four. And so
yeah, because the publishing gets doled out to like a billion different people, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it has been somewhat masochistic. The way I've kind of gotten around it is I focus on independent artists, or I'll get music from guests, and they're more willing to help me jump through the hoops because they're on the show. So most recent episode has Femi Kuti and Made Kuti, and so they basically connected me with all the people I needed to talk to get all the different licenses.
Yeah. All right. Wow. So I didn't realize. So it's amazing that, you know, even in your second time around, which I appreciate, that Peter self-flagellates at all points in his life. He never learns. So in this way, like, we're all on this podcast that same way. Do you think it's a good way to be?
Absolutely. You know what I say, and this is what I sometimes said at MoFed, was, you know, if this were easy, everybody else would have done this, right?
That is
and
true.
So you have to kind of. I mean, there's a reason why there weren't a ton of food museums out there. And so I think there is something to looking for hard paths, because that inherently means that probably nobody else is doing it. And so you just have to be willing enough or crazy enough to do that.
Yeah. And also, it's not the show. So the show, the Counter Jam, right? It's not like a, so you'll have like three guests, let's say, but it's not like a string of interviews. You kind of cut them back into each other. So you'll go back and forth between the different sets of interviews, kind of tracing a through line of questioning on your part. And like, you know, for instance, you'll have some people who are in New York, some people who are in Nigeria, some people who are in LA, I mean, not the same show. But then, you know, you're cutting back and forth and then like punctuating it with music. Is that pretty much the shtickety shtick?
Yeah. So that's also masochistic. Essentially, I just like get the interviews and then listen to everything and then try to pull out themes. And I think about like mapping out the episode after that. So it takes time, but it's fun.
Yeah. So the very first one, of course, you decided to stay kind of close to home. You had your moms on, which I thought was kind of cool. And you did Korean as your first thing. And by the way, this show, like the format of this show, kind of, if you need to know what Peter is like actually kind of like it's perfect. It's perfect Peter. Right, because it combines the things that he likes, but also what he's been working on for years, which is kind of using food as a touchstone to talk about culture in general and kind of how people grew up, and that's really what the museum is about. And I think that's why Peter, you know, was kind of interested in that project, anyways. Food as a way to discuss us as people. Us as, you know, as parts of our own culture and how to explore other cultures. Do you say that's fair?
Absolutely, yeah.
So his first one was, of course, his own, and he had Roy Choi from L.A., and he had his mom, and he had Margaret Cho on. So it was pretty funny, and what I learned most was that I didn't know, Peter, you're part of this customization, you're part of this, like, I'm going to just use what... like regular, like, you know, white bread Americans call them all ramen, but ramen customization, right? So you want to first go into the difference between ramen and ramyun and like describe. I didn't realize you were part of this fad. I feel like this is a huge, not a oh fad, but it's a huge thing outside of the community now. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, I mean, instant ramyun I've eaten many times my body weight over the course of my lifetime. I actually remember the very first time I had instant ramen. It was Sapporo Ichiban beef flavor. I freaking love this stuff. John can attest to the fact that I ate this like maybe 50% of the time for like lunch at work. but yeah, and then, I mean, I think for me, like, it's one of the ways I kind of learned to cook was by starting with instant ramen. And of course, instant ramen is the Korean version of instant ramen. which, you know, Nissin being the most well-known brand in the Japanese market. But Koreans have instant ramen. And I would say the main thing that distinguishes instant ramen from Japanese instant ramen is the spiciness of the broth. And then I would say typically you have a larger gauge noodle on the Korean instant ramen than on the Japanese instant ramen.
You're a larger gauge noodle.
That's right. That's my nickname. And so then, yeah, I mean, then like the great thing is that you can kind of like hack it in lots of different ways and you can do it super quickly. So I can make, what I love is that I can think about instant ramen and then I could have the bowl ready to eat within 5 minutes, which is pretty great. And so, yeah, I mean, I have a whole like flow chart in my head of like, do I do a dry noodle or a wet noodle? And if it's wet, like, do I want a cream, like a fatty broth or a non-fatty broth?
That's
like,
my nickname, dry, wet noodle. Wet noodle is my nickname. But tell us, you have this like kind of like a fusion nightmare that's your favorite, this kind of carbonara one that you were talking to Roy Choi about. And he said he was going to go out and try it. I wonder whether he did. Why don't you describe your favorite?
He actually sent me the picture right after the show. He made it and he loved it.
All right, so give it to me.
So here's the deal. Like, basically, you get the water boiling in your water kettle, take the bowl in the bowl, crack an egg into the bowl, drop two slices of American cheese into the bowl, take your powder packet of the soup packet, put about 2/3 in there. You don't need as much because you're not using any water. And then reserve the little noodle bits and reserve the dried vegetable. And then get your noodles boiling, and then it's going to take about 2.5 minutes to 3 minutes to get to your like perfect al dente texture. And then take the noodles out, drop them into the bowl in which you've put all this stuff, and then just mix that around. Oh, pardon me. I know that this is a family show. Mix that stuff around.
Peter's show is not a family show, by the way. There are more F-drums being dropped in Peter's show than, you know.
Yeah, and so then the egg, you beat the egg and it, and then the American cheese melts, and then there's like the noodle water that's clinging to the noodles, and it all comes together and turns into a sort of sauce. And then I top it, and this is what I say is the pièce de résistance. Top it with the dried noodle bits, and you top it also with the dried vegetables just to add some texture. And voila, you've got basically kind of like, I put in very heavy quotes, carbonara. Using instant ramen.
Yeah. So that's the Peter Kim. So when you make that at home, just know that you're making the Peter Kim. That's all I'm saying. And Nastasia,
yeah.
I don't know.
And you can eat it in like 3 slurps.
I don't know if you realize this, Nastasia. Tell me if you did. But did you know that we not only have Peter Kim on the show, we have DJ Omega 60.
I know. I remember.
DJ
Omega
60.
That was how he contacted us to work for the museum before it was a museum. That email.
What?
That email address was
Omega 60. Yeah. Then how is he not in your phone? Peter Kim.
Peter's still Peter Lawyer.
Peter Lawyer, but why wasn't it Peter Omega 60?
I didn't take that seriously.
Wow.
Well, I don't think I ever explained to you what Omega 60.
You did.
Meant.
You did. I mean, eventually, but yeah.
Oh yeah.
Still didn't take it seriously.
Yeah. So Peter, on his very first podcast, Peter ended it, I'm sure, because, you know, also you could get the rights for it. Now I know that also you're building your life around what you can get the rights for. Played like some of his just coming back from the state, coming back from Cameroon to the States, his DJ song, Alphaville, right?
Yep.
Yeah. We don't have rights for it, so we can't play it. But if you want to hear, for all of you who have for years enjoyed Peter coming on the show, you should listen at the very least to that first episode so you can hear Peter's mom talking to him, and also listen to Peter as Omega 60. Yeah. But
and there's a whole story behind the name, which I won't go into now. It's on the episode. But I remember, you know, it's so funny. Like, I remember at one point, like, and I've never really talked to people much. I don't talk to people much about my music, but there was one time in Philly when I finally was like ready to tell somebody about Omega 60, and their reaction was, "Oh, you mean like the fatty acid?" And that's when I like I shrank back into my shell and I was like, "I'm never telling anybody again."
All right. So while we're still talking about the show, because I have a couple of questions, mostly about Injera. Actually, let's do the question first, and we'll go back to the show. So two different people, Robert Lax and Capri Sun. I don't remember Capri Sun. Wrote in and said that they saw that you were making Injera and they'd like to make some. Now, again, listeners of the show, people who know Peter will know that he not only has a connection with Cameroon from when he was in the Peace Corps, but also with Ethiopia, where he used to go on the regular because his wife was stationed there at the UN for years. And so you did injure. So I have two questions. Can you talk about how you make it and where you get your TEF? That's from Robert Lax. And well, and the exact same question basically from Capri Sun. So you, two people want to know about injera and TEF.
Yeah, yeah. So describe injera for those who don't know,
by the way.
Yes. So injera is a fermented crepe-like bread, and it is a staple of injera. It's made with TEF, which is, as I understand it, the world's smallest grain. And it has a very sour flavor owing to the fermentation process. And then it has the flavor of TEF, which is pretty distinctive. I don't even know how to describe it. I feel like people like to use the word nutty for everything, but I don't like that. So,
what does that mean?
It tastes like TEF. I know exactly. So it tastes like TEF. And so if you want to learn it, then try tasting TEF.
It doesn't taste like whole wheat. It doesn't taste like buckwheat, yeah. Right? It doesn't taste like any of those things.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just got its own flavor. And you probably know, you know, when you eat it, you lay it flat on a platter, and then you put all these various soups and stews on top of it. In terms of sourcing TEF for the injera, I mean, I had kind of an advantage because I had a big bag of TEF that we bought, that my wife and I bought in Ethiopia on our last trip there. And so I've just been using that, and I haven't really had to use any TEF I've sourced in the U.S. for a while. I can't help you there. In terms of the overall process,
when you buy it, is it like tiny like amaranth or like small millet, or do you buy it ground in Ethiopia already?
I bought it ground in Ethiopia.
Okay. And how long does it last?
I don't know, but like in this case, I used the last of it, and it was maybe 2 years out, and it was still good. So,
all right, go ahead. Sorry.
I don't know. The process is like it's really simple, actually. It's simple in theory, hard to execute, but you just let, you know, add water and let it ferment, and then it gets like this sour smell to it. And the time, as you all know, will depend on your temperature and, you know, the particular TEF that you're using. But figure 3 or 4 days. And then, when it's ready to go, the big thing is it's really hard to cook and keep intact. And then what you want to do is you want it to cook without like browning on the bottom but you want it fully cooked on the top. And that can be a little bit tricky. The biggest piece of advice I'd have for people is don't try on your first time to do it on your stovetop, but start with an electric crepe maker or something that provides a really even low heat, because on the stovetop, it's just a nightmare. Even the small variations in how your pan heats up just screws up the whole thing.
So originally, like way back in the day, was it done with a ground product or was it wet ground like the way that you would do like idli or dosa batter? Do you know?
I have no idea.
Because I wonder, like, whether that's something. Because, like, I find it very difficult to grind tiny grains and get like good results. You know what I mean? Like, before I had my grinders, I tried to grind, you know, fonio, which is an African like very tiny millet. Before Pierre Chan was bringing it in, and I had kind of difficult results to get it to work exactly the way I wanted. But I wasn't using a wet grinder. I wonder whether you could wet grind whole TEF. Because what's easier to get here in the States? Most of the African markets here are primarily West African markets, right?
Well, in New York City. But if you go to D.C., I mean, you're good. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh,
and
so
New York City is not really a good Ethiopian market.
All right. But like there, and it's fairly easy to get the ground TEF.
Yeah, I mean, Bob's Red Mill sells ground TEF.
Is it good?
I've not tried it, but I know that they do sell it. And I don't think it's particularly hard to find TEF now.
TEF's super expensive, though, right? Or it used to be. Is it still?
I don't know. Like I said, I mean, I've had the good fortune of just having the stuff I bought in Ethiopia.
And are you a 100% TEF person, or are you a 50-50 split? What do you do?
Oh, man, definitely 100%. And that's also one thing I'd say is if you go to an Ethiopian restaurant, then this is actually a pretty universal practice across Ethiopian restaurants in the U.S., as far as I can tell. Your injera you're going to generally get at an Ethiopian restaurant in the U.S. will be only partially TEF. And if you want the TEF, you have to call 24 hours in advance, and they will make the TEF for you, the TEF injera for you. And so if you're thinking of going to a restaurant, think of it a day in advance and call ahead and ask for the tefinjera. You have to pre-order a certain quantity, but it's definitely worth it.
And in general, that works? Like most Ethiopian restaurants, Eritrean restaurants will do that for you?
Pretty much everyone that I have come across does that, yeah.
Did you have to bust out some, you could do it in English? Like you don't have to know anything? You don't have to be special?
No. Yeah. No. And I think it's just, yeah, I mean, it's. I think in general, I'm not even going to hypothesize as to why they all are able to do it, but it is the case. Yeah, so try it.
Now, for those that have never had it before, I've only had 100% teff injera once, and it was extremely sour. Like, I assume that it doesn't always need to be as sour as the one that I had. It's definitely worthwhile to sample that, right? Don't you think so?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's like, to me, like the having the super sour teff injera is the perfect counterpoint to the stews, and definitely worth trying because that's what a lot of the stuff you'll find in Ethiopia is like. And it might not be your bag, but then if you're making it at home, you can just simply ferment it less.
Right. Now, do you think...
I have no idea. I would guess you would have majority non-teff in your injera.
Based on the flavor of what I've had in, you know, New Haven and New York Ethiopian restaurants, I would say, yeah, the vast majority of it is wheat flour. Like, the good percentage of it. You know what I mean? Right, Peter, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
I mean, teff's also a lot more money. And, you know, back in the day, it was rarer, right? So there was a monetary reason not to do it. And then I'm sure there's some, we don't think Americans will like it kind of a situation as well, right?
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure, like, I don't know what the wholesale market is like for teff, but, you know, you can get flour for dirt cheap wholesale.
Yeah. But you should try, everyone should get the full teff at least once. All right, now back to your show for a minute. So one of the through lines I noticed was, and it's something I guess that we didn't talk about a lot. You know, you and I personally, when we were hanging out, was kind of this feeling of being embarrassed by the food of your own culture, and it comes up repeatedly in the podcast, and it's kind of an interesting thing. It's an interesting thing to think about. You want to talk about that as a through line?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is like a recurring theme on the show, is talking about what folks ate when they were kids, and you know, I think you know, it's a remarkably common experience that for immigrant families, when you're a kid, you eat the stuff that your family gives you, and your family, especially if they're recent immigrants, is going to make you stuff that's is what they would have eaten in their home country, and that's going to be in stark contrast to what everybody else around you is eating, and it's something you'll just hear over and over. Like Korean kids are embarrassed of the smell of kimchi in their home when their friends come over. Indian kids are embarrassed about the smell of the various curries and chutneys that their parents are making when their friends come over, and on down the line. And so, but what's interesting is, of course, in generally speaking, as you get older, you start to, you know, realize there's nothing to be embarrassed about this. And in fact, you start owning it. And on top of that, I would say food culture in the U.S. has shifted such that there is a larger acceptance of a wider spectrum of flavors, even among people who aren't from the cultures that have those flavors. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it is one of these things that is kind of a through line.
Yeah. Dan, well, you and Dan the Automator. So like some of the people he has on, he has Dan the Automator, you know, Dan Nakamura. He was saying that, you know, he specifically thinks that kind of at least his generation, his parents' generation, self-repression of their own culture, which extends to certain parts of the foods, is due to the internment camps, right? That was one of the things that he mentioned. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, so that episode is actually one of my favorites because the three guests, and this almost just happened by chance. One guest is a woman who immigrated herself to Vancouver, Yumi Nagashima. And then the other guest was this rapper from North Carolina whose family immigrated, his parents immigrated from Japan and opened a restaurant in North Carolina. And then Dan is somebody who's been around, and he's like third or fourth generation Japanese American. And Yumi, of course, eats Japanese food all the time, every day. G, the rapper from North Carolina, he grew up eating Japanese food, but, you know, it's just like a part of his experience, but not define, doesn't define his food identity. So it's like kind of similar to me. And then Dan, it's like, I didn't grow up eating Japanese food, really. And when you really get down to the difference, Dan's theory was that, yeah, his grandparents were put into the internment camps, and his parents grew up, were like 3 or 4 years old when they went to the internment camps. And that not just with his family, but a lot of Japanese Americans who lived through that, they essentially afterwards suppressed their own culture because of just the horror of being thrown in an internment camp and the fear of something like that happening again for just sticking out too much. And so...
Right, desire to conform.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And so to me, like, I mean, I've obviously thought a lot about like, well, I was gonna say obviously, but I have thought a lot about how horrific the internment camps, the idea, the fact that that happened and all that is, but I had never really thought about the effect on culture, honestly. And that was interesting.
Yeah. And so, and then the episode that we haven't talking about yet is the one where you do Nigerian food. You have on Ego Nwoden, the comedian, and which was funny because you're like lobbing a bunch of stuff at her, and like some of the stuff that, you know, you like from when you were there, stuff that's kind of classic, she doesn't like, which was kind of hilarious.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But you want to talk about your connection. Well, I will say one thing first of all, because he brings this up. So Peter Kim, he, when, you know, after he graduated college, he went to the Peace Corps. He was in Cameroon, right? But you said you were on the border, like the village you were in was kind of near the border with, right? So it's like,
with
you
Nigeria.
Feel like you,
yeah, right.
Yeah, you feel like you had exposure to kind of like food from that region. And also at the beginning of the show, you mentioned that, you know, it's a kind of a false border anyway, right?
Right.
Like the country borders over there are all, you know, false borders anyway. And so you feel like, you know, you have, you know, you're cathected somewhat to Nigerian food. And so you when you were in the, you know, over there working, like one of the things you were doing was setting up like art education, right, for kids?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And Peter Kim, and you might not know this, but I wish we could post this on the our
I know where you're going
website.
With this.
Yeah. Peter Kim has on his phone, and it's available within 13 seconds of asking him at any time, possibly the greatest artwork that's ever been made. It's you know, for those of you that are, you know, here in New York City, you can go right now to the Metropolitan Museum of Art and see the Goya print and drawing exhibition, which is, by the way, amazing. And I love Goya because like the kind of depth of kind of just how awful humans can be, but also kind of pathos and how like just weird humans can be. Like, I think Goya is one of the greatest artists at just representing that, at just kind of like the holy crap of life. And, you know, it's especially, you know, and if all you know about Francisco Goya is like, you know, the, you know, small rich children in like red outfits, then you're really kind of missing out, I think, on the greatest part of one of my favorite artists. Anyway, but this drawing that one of your students did is almost like a Goya, like a Goya print, like one of the Capriccios or something. It's like, it's amazing drawing. And you want to describe this drawing, Peter?
So what I did in Cameroon was I paired public health education with art classes. So the kids would learn how to draw, but they'd also learn about the health issues associated with whatever they're learning to draw. And in this case, the person was learning about, diarrhea and I can't remember what it was exactly, but something where the symptom was diarrhea. And so he drew a depiction of a man squatting and having the most horrific explosive diarrhea you've ever seen, with like complete with flies, you know, swimming around and like grimace on the face and the whole thing. And I will say that, okay, the image is pretty remarkable, but I think Dave's reaction to that was even more remarkable, because if you know Dave, it's like 90% of the time you fly something by him, you're like, eh, okay, whatever, eh, yeah, whatever. And then like you put this drawing of a guy having diarrhea in front of Dave, and suddenly he's like, what is this masterpiece? And then like you had this weird fascination with it. I mean, it is an amazing drawing, but I don't know that I ever really would have held it up as this sort of like emblematic example of I don't know what, but yeah.
Well, it's just this guy is having a terrible moment.
Yeah.
And it's just captured, right? And so like he's not even Like, he has no, like, it's a person. So, Nastassja, you like this picture too, right?
I don't really remember it.
What?
What?
So if you look, if you look at his eyes, right? He's a person, right? So he has his own thoughts and dreams, and he's not happy about what's happening to him. But all of his agency in life has been removed, like all of it. He has no more agency, and he's just like a vehicle for his butt being set on spray. And so it's just like this image of like resignation and debasement.
Dave, I was talking to somebody about this a couple days ago about how
This picture?
No, about how when you have to go like that and it's like that, you become an animal. Like when you're like, this person has thoughts and hopes and dreams, like that's all of us. Yeah, yeah. Like when that happens to you.
But that's what makes it a great picture. But if you look capture, at this guy's if you look at the guy's eyes also, like, you never know. Like, maybe he has cholera. Maybe he's going to die. Who knows? Because he didn't even make it to, like, a bathroom or whatever. He's just out there on spray, like, with like, flies out. You don't know, like, you know, you don't know what the future holds for this person. You know what I mean? And it's
brilliant
all...
formal analysis, Dave. This is the kind of stuff you learned at your MFA.
This is, Columbia.
I know. We're doing, like, an art critique on this.
Have you know, I am a trained MFA, folks. I get to say whatever I want. But
I'm happy to share this image, and you can put it out on Twitter so folks can see the wonder and beauty of this.
It's the flies. Yeah. Well, you have permission from the artist. You said you kept in contact with this person, right?
Oh, I guess. You know what? You're right. This is something we'll have to ask him about that.
Yeah. There's the trained MFA talking about, do we have the rights on the art? Anyway. Yeah. So, by the way. In that episode, Peter Kim said the most Peter Kim thing ever. Nastassja, he said, there's something so satisfying about the tactile sensation of manipulating a doughy ball. I rewound and listened to him saying that like three times because he was talking about fufu. You want to talk fufu and all the various fufus?
Yeah, so fufu is... It's pounded starch or a porridge that, it can be a pounded starch like yams or cassava, or it can be a porridge made from, you know, grains mixed with water. And what's common about fufu, whatever the ingredient is that it's essentially ends up being a lump of starch that you rip little pieces off of with your hand, and then you manipulate the doughy ball in your hand, and then you dip it into a stew. And eat it that way. And, you know, and I say this on the show, but like it's inherently a neutral staple. I mean, it's not full of flavor, but the point of it is to be something that you scoop up sauce with. So,
but it can be more.
I hate it when people
sour,
like diss
though, right?
Fufu as being bland, because I'm like, that's the point. It's like rice or like anything that's just like a plain like staple. What's that?
But it can be more or less sour as well though, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It can be
so
made
some
with different grains and.
Yeah, so you could do it with fermented cassava, and then you're going to get a little more of a sour flavor, for example.
But like neutral is such a bad term for any grain product, right? I mean, like, has anyone ever come home to a house where someone has cooked rice and not think that rice has like a thing? You know what I mean? Like grains have their own smell and their own taste.
Yeah,
right? No,
absolutely. No, of course it has its flavor, but I've seen people where they will blast fufu for being flavorless. And sure, every fufu has a flavor, of course, like any other kind of staple. But it's not, like, flavorful like the stew that you're supposed to eat it with is.
Right.
So, anyway. But I will say that, I mean, I do love fufu. I think the general mode of eating is something I find very enjoyable. It is something I ate a lot of while I was in Cameroon. And then I will occasionally make at home. And especially if I go to any kind of West African restaurant, I'll always opt for the fufu. It's nice. I mean, like, you just, yeah. I mean, there's a motion you do with the ball of fufu in your hand, and you turn it into a little scoop. At least I do. And I love it.
And what would you say about the tactile sensation of manipulating that doughy ball?
Well, how would you
categorize it?
I think anybody can relate with this. Like, you have a soft, squishy thing in your hand, and you, oh, God, this is going to go in the wrong direction. But, like, you know what I mean? Like, you have, like, something. But, you know, if you have something, like, It's like having Play-Doh in your hand. It's a pleasant thing to to squeeze.
Yeah. Nastasia, what are your thoughts?
You know what I'm thinking about. My favorite story ever.
Favorite Peter story? Yeah. Well, okay. We can't have Peter on without talking about the story. Mainly because, well, for those of you that don't know, like, Peter coined a phrase about Nastasia. You wanna talk about this phrase, Peter?
Are you talking about the name I have for her?
No, I'm talking about, yeah, the German term. Yeah.
Yeah, Stassenfreude. Because, as I think many of the listeners of this show have gleaned, what brings great joy to Nastasia is to see other people suffer. And it's not that she's created the suffering. She has not in any way intervened in people's lives to create the suffering. It's just observing it and basking in it. And so this, it's a special brand of course, Schadenfreude, which is a word probably you all know, and it's Stassenfreude.
Yeah, because it's very specifically like Nastasia-like.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, so who's going to tell this one? Peter. This has been told a million times on the show. I guess Peter's never told.
No. Nastasia, if this is coming out, it's you're telling the story, not me.
Yeah. You know what, Nastasia? You always make other people do this.
Peter walked in on Dave taking a dump.
The way you tell it is like freaking.
And it was one of the top five moments of my life.
Yeah, Nastasia, for anyone that enjoys any of the products or anything that Booker and Dax has ever made or done, Nastasia would have quit long ago if she hadn't had her batteries recharged at Williams College by this interaction. It gave her like maybe 3 years of gas in the tank, right?
I have never seen such pure joy on Nastasia's face as when that happened. It was pure joy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was great.
I wish we had a video of Nastasia's face because according to Peter, she was like almost vibrating.
I reached I reached Nirvana. Yeah.
She was on the ground and just like, I mean, I don't know. Like, it's what
it
I imagine
like
somebody who's like taking every drug combined.
It wasn't a secondhand experience. I got to experience, most people don't get to see the thing, you know, but I got to see
it. You know what it's like? It's like train spotting and like the such a perfect day. And like Nastasia's just floating.
Yeah. All right. Let's get to some questions. As usual, Peter. Well, do you have anything? You have anything else you want to say before we do?
Who's been your favorite guest, Peter?
That's a good question.
I would say Femi Kuti and Made Kuti were pretty amazing. And I mean, not just because for me, like, just it's music that I legit have loved for so long and really shaped me a lot. But they were just a lot of fun. It was a lot of fun to have the father son combo on.
And for those that don't know, this is Fela's son and grandson, right?
That's right. Yeah. And Femi played with Fela. So Egypt 70 was one of the bands that backed up Fela, and Femi was in Egypt 70. And then Made has learned from his father as well. And so it's a really great lineage. And their music, all of it's really great. That's my favorite guest.
They also have a club restaurant, right?
Yeah, called The Shrine.
Did you go? You ever gone?
No. I mean, I've never been to Nigeria, so I would love to go. That's it. And I'd say, tune into counterjam.com and let me know what you think.
Well, you start that episode, they have to kick in a generator to get they have to kick in their second generator because their first generator died and apparently their electricity was cutting out constantly. So Peter's like nervous. Yeah. He's not going to get the interview, but it ends up actually being like they end up being really cool. You know what I mean? Like not like, I mean, obviously they're cool, but I mean like, they end up being kind of like cool to talk to, right?
Yeah, they were great. It was definitely challenging because there was such a heavy delay that we had to there was a lot of confusion from the delay too, but it worked out.
Yeah. I know what this is like. There's a huge father-son argument in this episode that boils down because Peter like has the question that he asks. So like, you know, Nastasia is always like, how much to cut off your right toe? How much to whatever? You know what I mean? And, you know, how much to, you know, do X horrible thing with X horrible person? But Peter, what's your stock question?
If you were stuck on a desert island and you had to eat one dish for the rest of your life, what would it be?
But you also, for the purposes of your show, you narrow it to like one that's within the culture you're talking about.
That's so right, of course. Yeah,
it's not like, you know what I really like? Big Macs, love them. Right. Yeah. So it's yeah. So, but then
it's not the most delicious. It's like what would you would actually want to eat day in and day out for the rest of your life.
And for anyone that like, for most people, they tend to cop out and try to like pick something that includes like everything. You know what I mean? Like they want like everything yes. in one dish. They try, right? But the hilarious thing is that so like the son or grandson, he's like Made. He's like he mentions a dish with both turkey and chicken, and his dad loses his mind on the son, and he's like, "What's so messed up is that he has both plantain and starch, which I guess." You know, you could count kind of in similar kind of baskets. And so the son's like, you have both plantain and starch. Why can't I have both chicken and turkey? And the dad's like, because it's two different bodies. It's two different living bodies. You can't bring two. You know what I mean? It's just this kind of great kind of back and forth, I thought. I don't know.
It was great. It was great.
All right. Well, any other questions you have, Nastasia, before we go into our kind of standard cooking issue style questions?
No, Peter. I think, I'm so happy to see your show doing so well.
Yeah. Who you got in your next season? Apparently it's coming up in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, I've got one of the episodes that we're doing is on Jewish American food. And I've got Eitan Bernath and Ilana Glazer on for that one. So that'll be fun. Yeah. And I'm working. Other ones I can't disclose just yet, but it's going to be great.
This episode is brought to you by Just Egg. You can't have plant-based breakfast without a plant-based egg. Just Egg is now the fastest growing egg brand in the United States. Bring more plant-based customers in your doors with easy-to-use Just Egg. You can start with a free sample. Just head to ju.st/hrn. Made from plants, Just Egg is a better egg for you and for the planet. It's healthier, with no cholesterol and less saturated fat. And it's more sustainable. Just Egg uses less water and generates fewer carbon emissions. Most importantly, it's delicious. For our listeners who operate a food service establishment, you can get a sample for free. Head to ju.st/hrn. Just Egg makes a delicious plant-based addition to any menu. It's available as a liquid scramble, great for omelets, frittatas, stir fries, and French toast. There's also a frozen, pre-baked folded version that's ideal for filling breakfast sandwiches or topping salads. Chef Jose Andreas calls Just Egg mind-blowing, and Bon Appetit says it's so good I feel guilty eating it. Put the fastest growing egg brand on your menu. Get a free sample of Just Egg for your restaurant at ju.st/hrn.
This episode is brought to you by The Great Grow Along, a 3-day hosted virtual garden festival connecting you with the influencers, tastemakers, and cutting-edge content of today's gardening world. The Great Grow Along will feature 40-plus sessions on topics ranging from houseplants to DIY landscaping. New plant parents and first-time gardeners will gain practical advice and creative inspiration from celebrated garden experts and industry leaders. Costing $29.95, tickets allow attendees to mix and match a wide range of sessions, or choose to follow one of the conference's 6 tracks, which include edible gardening, urban gardening, pollinators and plants, DIY landscaping, houseplants, and dig deeper. The Great Grow Along will take place March 19th through 21st, 2021. Sign up at greatgrowalong.com.
All right, so let's do some stuff. Okay, you want to go like full Nastasia doesn't care, or like halfway?
You should try to do both.
All right, I'm going to go full you don't care. From Monty via email, dear Cooking Issues crew, hope you're staying warm and hydrated. What would you look for in a freeze dryer? They seem pretty expensive. Are there any DIY alternatives? I have a friend who travels on motorcycles quite a bit and wants to freeze dry his homegrown produce. Thanks. Monty from Jacksonville, Oregon. All right. So traditional freeze dryers are extraordinarily expensive and they have relatively low throughput. And you can't really DIY it because you need a cold trap. It needs to be extremely cold. And, you know, and most things that you could consider to be DIY freeze drying, like, don't end up looking like what you want from a freeze dryer. I'm thinking like chunyos from like Peru, where, you know, you could do that just by literally freezing it and then desiccating them and back and forth, but that's not what you're looking for. There is now, so cheap for a freeze dryer is about $5,000. And you can get one for, I think, between $3,000 and $5,000 now that's meant for food preppers. And during the COVID time, I'm sure everyone who's prepping food, you know, for the future zombie apocalypse and whatnot, and for when we get a disease that wipes us out even harder than this one, I'm sure the price, probably the price has stayed constant, actually, the same way grain mills have. But they're out there now. I forget the name of the company. It's like something Harvest, like Good Harvest or Good Nature Harvest. And it gets relatively good reviews. It's relatively home-friendly, and it's relatively expensive relative to the $10,000 Lab Conco freeze dryers that you could get. But look for a large enough cavity that you can do a good amount of product, and stay away from the ones that just freeze-dry bottles, because therein lies a pain in your butt. But that's what most lab people want to do. Was that a decent answer? Fast enough?
Yes.
All right. There is a carbonation question. What do you think?
No.
I'll stay away from it.
Remember, that was the whole point of you making that video, that you would never answer another one, so you would point them to the video?
This person wants to carbonate cocktails with a McCann carbonator. I would
he
say stay away
go,
from it.
Get your book or talk to somebody else.
Wow. I feel like people, here's the thing. If you're asking a carbonation question, it's like just a trigger for Nastasia.
No,
like,
it's because you told me to keep you on track. And when someone in the future asks about carbonation, that you would point them to the resources that you made because you spent a lot of time on them. So I'm just doing what you said. But if you don't want to, go ahead and answer it.
Somehow I'm a bad guy again. I don't even know what it is. It's not the same question that the video addresses is the problem, but it's just you in general just hate any carbonation question. It's like me asking you to do quick agar freeze thaw. Or not quick agar.
Allow
quick
me to jump in and do a general call for carbonation questions, please.
Wow. Stirring the pot. This is Peter doing his own Stasenfreude. Yeah. This is Peter doing his own Stasenfreude.
I'm just kidding.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Do people still say half in jest, whole in earnest? I grew up hearing that constantly.
No.
People don't use that phrase anymore? No? It's a good one. Because it's like every time someone's joking, they really mean it. When was the last time someone was joking and they were just joking?
Right. Yeah. Well, the other classic thing you can always say is bless his heart, right?
Oh, yeah.
Bless your heart.
Did you say that up in Illinois? I thought that was only Southerners who said that. I think it was in Illinois, too.
Yeah, yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I grew up in a Hallmark store.
Right.
Oh, my God. That's true. Another picture that we can share because Peter owns it is a very depressed-looking young Peter Kim on a bench.
No, I don't think he's on a bench.
Isn't he? Doesn't he have his helmet off? He has his helmet off. I thought he was seated.
Peter, what is it?
Yeah. In I'm my dressed mind, he's as like a precious moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
With the helmet off.
Because we had holiday parties and, you know, I had to be the person who dressed up as a precious. It's a family business, so who else is going to wear the precious moment costume? And I took pictures with all of these.
What about your brother? They didn't
collectors.
Make your brother do it?
My brother was already in college at that point.
Okay. All right. So, like, I want, like, in my mind, here's what it is. It's like, you had just listened to Fogarty's Put Me in Coach, I'm Ready to Play. Your dress, as for some reason, this minor league baseball team has a precious moments thing as their mascot. And you've decided that you can play center field because the center fielder is injured, and you know you're at least as good as the injured center fielder. And you take off the furry head, and the coach still says no. And you sit on the bench and you look down. That's what it says to me. This picture, like this, is that's the image in my mind. Man, so and like. The thing is like, do you regret sharing these kinds of things with Nastasia and me, knowing that, like, as soon as we see that kind of image of whatever you want to call that, that it's there forever and it never goes away?
No, I'm happy if I can bring a brief moment of joy to your lives.
Yeah,
I feel like we share equally, like, horrible things.
Yeah.
You hardly ever share. Well, there's the one. We can't talk about it. But Nastasia, you try to keep your horrible stuff under the, like, close to the chest there. You know what I mean? You're not so much on sharing your heart.
That's not true.
Okay.
I showed you guys the most horrible thing. That's true. Yeah,
that's true. So after maybe 8-9 years, we've been, and Peter's been in the, you know, we've known each other. Maybe we've been only together like two years as working together when we met Peter, right? Right, Nastasia, something like that.
Yeah, maybe.
So it's been like a long time. Anyway.
Yeah.
It was like maybe 8 years before Nastasia shared this one thing, and I will never share it with the world, ever.
It's only because I couldn't find photo evidence, and as soon as I did, I showed you.
It wasn't photo evidence, video evidence.
Yes.
Video and photo evidence. Yeah, it's out there, people.
It's not out
ominous.
There.
It's out there.
It's not out
ominous.
There.
Ominous.
Yeah. All right. So 91, Alexander, I think it's, I can't remember whether it's Tileguard or Tailguard, sorry. You told me how to pronounce it last time. Had a honey dehydration question, and all he wants is to, he's trying to get all of the liquid out of honey to make it into a powder and use it as a sugar, and doesn't care about the aroma or anything like that. Yeah, just throw it in a dehydrator. It'll dehydrate. Just be aware that it is extremely hygroscopic, so it will reabsorb moisture. So don't expect to have a free-flowing honey powder that you can just leave out and have it be working for you. From Keith Fitzgerald via email, and I spoke to Peter a little bit about this beforehand, had a question. Hope all is good. Could you ask Dave, and I'll just tell you, no, I do not have any experience. Do I have any experience with the Korean machine called the Oku, O-C-O-O, I'm assuming it's pronounced Oku, pressure cooker? I just obtained one, and I'm figuring it out. Be great to hear if I have any knowledge about double-chambered pressure cookers. And as a side question, what's the best way to cook whelks? Whelks. I didn't even see that last section of the question. Thanks, Keith, an Irish listener. Well, I've never had Irish whelks, but I'm assuming that because it's the Atlantic, they're pretty similar to the whelks that we used to catch off of the coast of Cape Cod. Any of you guys, other guys, cook whelk?
No.
Nope.
So whelk is kind of like it's like a crappy conch. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, imagine like they look like conch. Are you a conch or a conch? What do you guys? What do you prefer? I'll use whatever you prefer.
Conch.
Conch? All right. So like, whereas like the conch is this big kind of like awesome shell, and you can like turn it into like a horn, and it like looks pretty, and you can get the big thing out, and you can slice it and pound it and do all this other kind of stuff with it, and they sell it canned. Like whelk looks like that, but like busted. You know what I mean? Like small, like ish, dingy, and then when you pull it out, like it doesn't necessarily have a... So you guys ever like... You guys have all eaten some form of snaily / whelky / conky thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you know how when you pull it out, you have the muscle, which is what everyone's looking for, and then you got the goop-a-loop afterwards, that, you know, the stuff that you trim off and then pitch, you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah.
So I feel that the whelk has an unfavorable amount of goop-a-loop to the meat. And also the whelk that I used to catch live, like, had like a real kind of like, just kind of like a musty kind of like seaweed that's been out too long, kind of like aquarium water taste to it. And by the way, when I say fresh, literally, like, I would go into the water, get them, pull them out, and cook them right away. So it's not like they were stale or anything like that. So I'm going to say whatever I did to them. Now, fair point. The last time I did this was when I was 18. So it's been, you know, 32 years since I have done this. So I'm going to go ahead and say I have no good knowledge on you, but whatever I did, don't do that. Like, I would assume that you have to peel off and trim more than I did and maybe beat the ever-loving hell out of it. Now, if you want to talk about getting quahogs, I don't know if you have quahogs over there in Ireland, but those you make stuffies with. You guys like stuffies?
I have not had a lot of stuffy, but they look really good.
Yeah, stuffed clam, man. Who doesn't? I mean, Nastasia probably doesn't like a stuffed clam. I'm just guessing based on Nastasia's, like...
You're right. I don't like...
Yeah. Why don't you like a stuffed
clam? I don't know. It doesn't matter. Go.
What about you, John?
Yes, big fan.
Yeah, right? They're good.
Yeah, delicious.
And you can make them in all different kinds of flavors. Like, you take a really tough clam, you chop it up, you mix it with like breadcrumbs and other cool stuff, and then you broil it. Well, I mean, like, what's not to enjoy? You know,
to me, it evokes like stuffed potato skins from like TGI Fridays, which might sound horrible, but I love that, and I still dream about those tater skins.
TGI Fridays is famous for their potato skins. They have spent millions of dollars to make potato skins such that you will enjoy them, Peter. There's no shame in enjoying a TGI Friday potato skin, I don't think.
Yeah.
Do you know, I find that my potato skins, maybe I'll work on it, aren't very good. What about you? Have you ever made a potato skin that you really liked?
I've tried making it. I think it turned out all right, but I don't know that I really, I don't know.
The skin's never as crunchy as I want.
Right.
It gets papery. Do you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like, I haven't fully worked it out yet. Anyone else here a potato skin fan have good feelings on potato skins?
Love them. You're good.
Yeah? Do you like, but have you ever made them or do you just buy them from TGI Fridays?
Never made them.
Yeah. I made them and I couldn't get them as crispy as I wanted.
So maybe we should work on this. Maybe I'll work on it for the miracle. It is a moisture management problem and I do have a whole section on potatoes.
Oh, Dave, we're supposed to talk about the quest.
Oh, all right, give me a second. Let me. So this pressure cooker, because I mentioned Keith's question, and I have not used one of these things, but I had Peter look at it right before the show to see whether like he had any sort of like knowledge of where this might have come from. But what it is it's like a ceramic. There's like a pot and a steamer insert that fit into a stainless steel. Vessel. So there's a stainless steel pressure cooker with a pressure cooker lid, but interposed between the lid and the base, you can put these ceramic pots. So it's like a combination, like pressure cooker. It's kind of like a very expensive hardcore Instapot thing. But I think it's made for commercial use. So do you see any kind of anything in this that rings any bells, Peter, or anything that gives you any feelings about cooking and crockery in general?
No, but when you mentioned it, I did the quick Google image search of stuff you could make with it, and it looks pretty phenomenal.
Yeah, I mean, I like ceramics. I do like ceramics. I'm not like, so Nastassi and I once went to Paula Wolfert's house. You guys remember the author Paula Wolfert? Anyway, so we went with Harold McGee, and this was, I believe, right after we had eaten 10,000 citrus fruits, and I was on my way to trying to go set myself on spray, the best day of my life where my butt was set on spray, but I was spraying out orange juice. It was the best thing ever. Anyway, so on the way home from that, we went and stopped at Paula Wolfert's house, and she's a huge devotee, I don't know whether she's still around, of cooking in clay. And she wrote a book on cooking in clay. And there's a huge group of people who are like extremely stoked about cooking in clay. And I've just never become one of these clay heads. Any of you guys clay heads?
No.
No. All right.
I don't really get it.
But that's the thing. I don't really understand. I don't understand what it is that the clay is doing. And all the explanations are extremely mystical. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's like baking in salt. I don't quite understand that either.
Well, baking in salt. So in the 70s, baking in salt like was a huge thing. So they had two things that people did in the 70s. It was chicken in salt and fish in salt, like a whole fish in salt and a whole chicken in salt. And so the idea is that you have a bunch of salt around, which of course nobody did in the 70s. We just had regular, like, you know, people didn't. I don't feel like the kosher salt had become something that everyone had, you know, in their pantries unless they, you know, needed it for cultural reasons. Anyways. So you pack all of the salt around whatever you're going to cook, and it supposedly forms a shell, almost like baking in clay, right? So it's about sealing something in moisture. It's almost like it's like akin to like un papillote or sous vide or something like this. But so my mom did it with a chicken, and this was, you know, she was going out with my stepfather, but they hadn't been married yet, so this had to have been 1982. So I was 11, and so how many years ago? I'll be 50 in 2 weeks, so you can do the math. Like, and the salt collapsed, and there was no barrier. I don't know whether you're supposed to put a barrier. My mom had no barrier. The salt was literally packed around the chicken. And my mom's a phenomenal cook, by the way. But the salt collapsed into the chicken, and it was the saltiest chicken. Like, without any shadow of a doubt, the saltiest object that I've ever put into my mouth, and and I've eaten straight salted capers. You know what I mean? So it was like, it was just intense. And so also because it was I guess it was early 80s, I guess it wasn't 70s. You didn't say anything about it. You just ate it. You know what I mean? And so that's the thing I don't understand about kids these days. They always have something to say about the food that's served to them. It's like when I was a kid, you just ate whatever was put in front of you.
Blame the parents.
What? No, you just ate it, right? Oh, yeah. Nastasia has all sorts of things to say about parenting. We'll wait and see.
She witnesses a lot of it.
Yeah, kind of. So we didn't say anything. But to this day, every once in a while, my stepfather's like, remember the salt chicken? I'm like, Gerard, what the hell, man? You gotta my mom is 70, right? And she's cooked some of the best things that he's ever eaten in his whole life. You know what I mean? Plus, she is a pediatric cardiologist and runs a pediatric transplant program, the first pediatric heart transplant program in the United States, right? So, and he won't let her forget this one time that we had a super salty chicken. I just don't feel it's right to bring that up, you know? Remember the chicken, Lynn?
No one's going to come down on the side of Gerard here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Lynn, that's right. Lynn, you remember the chicken? You remember how salty it was?
Yeah. And to be fair, I imagine that baking in salt, and I haven't had a lot of stuff baked in salt really, but it's, it's festive and it's fun. It's a fun surprise to crack things open. But I just say I don't really understand beyond that, why you would do it. Which may be reasonable enough. I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. You ever go to Turkey?
Yeah. I was in Turkey.
Yeah, you ever have that thing baked in clay in Turkey, and then you go outside the restaurant and it's just there's piles of broken clay vessels?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's just kind of cool. I don't even care how the thing tastes.
Cool. So, I mean, and there's something to be said for, presentation format, ceremony, and it's great, but yeah.
Yeah, John, both Peter and John are both Francophiles and Francophones. But do you guys enjoy the fish that's cooked in a crust and then open tableside and deboned by the waiter?
I haven't had it, but I mean,
really?
I would order that to see that done in front of me. I think that'd be pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, to me, again, it doesn't matter how it tastes. The presentation is almost enough in that case.
I guess
not
I would
the kind
put,
of thing I would want to do.
I would put beef Wellington in the same bucket. It's like a delicious combination of things, but really it's also about the surprise of what cutting into that.
Yeah, yeah. But I guess the nice thing about the fish is that they do it tableside, and then do you enjoy the old school, the French way of not touching it and just using the two, using the fork and the thing to get all of the bones out, lay them aside, and have the four, it's always with a flat fish, and have the four perfect fillets?
Pure class. I love it.
Right?
Mm. Yeah.
It's magic, right? I mean, it's that's not the way I cook. It's not the way I would ever cook. But when someone is I'm just going to go dot all these I's and cross all these T's and do it, you're like, props, no?
Yeah, yeah. Agreed.
Yeah, yeah. All right, so we have to talk about the quest, but I'm going to ask you guys this question. I'll answer it next time because I don't understand exactly what's being gotten at, all right? So listen to this question, and then you guys tell me what it means, and then I will think about it for next time. Devin Patel wrote, unless you have an answer, Devin Patel wrote in, I've recently been looking at purchasing equipment and I'm trying to distinguish between what is sold as quote unquote industry standard. Okay, to not bring about a spotlight and hurt someone's business, I want to keep it vague. So Devin's not telling me exactly which company is saying that they're an industry standard, but I'm finding it hard to read between the lines here, all right? So my question is, when looking at industry-specific equipment to purchase and comparing it to another piece of equipment that is industry-adjacent but looks and does exactly the same thing, like a scale. So I guess buying a butcher scale versus a counting scale for a deli versus a postal scale. I mean, maybe that's what we're talking about. How can you tell if the materials and build are quality and that the price doesn't just get jacked up because it's specific for an industry? So I guess medical stuff and stuff like that could be. Is that what he's talking about? You have any thoughts on it before? Should I just cogitate on it?
I have no idea.
Sounds like everything you try and do. Finding parts and then finding cheaper parts in related industries that do achieve the same thing in the end.
Right. Like when I started out in this, it was about like finding things from other industries that chefs didn't use. There was a mad dash to get any piece of equipment and use it. That's how ultrasonic homogenizers and ultrasonic cleaners and all sorts of, rotovaps and all this, even immersion circulators. It started with the immersion circulator, and that was how everyone was like, let me look at anything else that can be used for cooking. But I think here it's more like there is something already that's being sold for cooking, but I want to use it for something else, right? And how do you tell? I mean, the first thing is whether it's food grade or not, right? That's the other issue. Also, Devin believes this, and I'm going to throw this out there because we have to talk about the quest. Sorry, real quick, Matt. And Peter will appreciate this because it's a horror show. Anyway, so Devin says, salt to taste for recipes is a cop-out. This is Devin saying this. This is a statement. Just saying, if it's your recipe, then you get to decide how much salt it gets and the power's in your hands. All the salty power. Sincerely, Devin. I don't know that I agree with that just because, salt is... It's so hard to control with what raw ingredients you have and any other kind of changes or mistakes. Whenever you read someone's recipe, when you write a recipe, you have to write a recipe knowing it will be mangled, right? Go and read any review section of any recipe website or reviews of recipes in a book. They're like, I loved it, but I substituted beef for chicken, I omitted the starch, and I added a whole bunch of cheese, and I loved it. You know what I mean? Or I did that, and I hated it. The recipe didn't work. All I did was substitute, I took away the starch, and I added cheese, and I substituted the beef for the chicken. But the recipe didn't work. What a moron. And so, when you know that you're going to have your recipe completely butchered, right? And you don't know exactly what ingredients someone's going to use. It's very hard to write a specific amount of salt. And also, salt is the ingredient that people F up the most because someone will say, first of all, someone will say 2 teaspoons kosher salt. They won't even say whether it's Morton or Diamond, right? Which is, you're already off by a factor of a third at least. And then God forbid someone used granulated iodized. It's just almost impossible. And no one reads that fine. And nobody gives enough of a crap to actually get that stuff right. And so I think it's almost impossible to write salt into a recipe accurately. What do you guys think? Unless you do it by weight. But then you still have to put a teaspoon or a volumetric measurement next to it because otherwise people are going to be like, I don't know, I'm not going to weigh salt. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
I don't know. I think
yeah.
It's just really difficult. I don't think it's a – I don't – in other words, and people really do have radically different salt tolerances. And if you're trying to give someone a recipe, I think there's really something to be said for allowing somebody to adjust your vision because they're going to eat it. You're not going to eat it. You know what I mean? They're going to eat it. So, I find when I'm doing a recipe, I will tell someone how I like it, but then I'm not going to eat it. So I just, I don't know. I don't think it's a cop-out. I think it's a cop-out. It's a cop-out to not measure it and tell people what you think, but I don't think it's a cop-out to tell people why there's fudge or wiggle room.
Yeah, I'm on the same page as you. I think the places where I want to have salt measured out is a baking recipe. And then actually another area where it's actually, you don't see the salt often measured out, but it should be for sure, is with pickles. It's really hard. Sometimes it's really hard to find a pickle recipe where they give you the actual just by weight percentage of salt that they want to aim at. And to me, that's really annoying.
Oh, super annoying. Super annoying. And first of all, I don't understand. Everyone should go back and just the way every brine recipe should work is it should be the amount of salt for total weight of brine plus product.
Exactly. Yeah. I hate it that you have add a cup of salt and then add water to fill the jar. I'm like, well, how big's the jar?
Yeah.
How dense is your ingredient? I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, right. And so that especially goes, a lot of pickles are done dry. The only pickles that have recipes that make sense are the ones that are done dry and they create their own brine because then at least it starts with some rational percentage, right? But the ones where you're just topping up with water, it's an absurdity. And it's look, if you're writing a recipe for brining chicken and you're only going to brine the chicken for 2 hours, then sure, focus on the concentration of the brine, right? But if you're going to do, what we refer to as equalization, right, where you're going to, pretty much equalize the salt content throughout the entire batch, Then place the salt on the whole weight, chumps. You know what I mean? Yeah, you're right, Peter. It's completely irritating. And so widespread. So yes. Widespread.
Try finding a kimchi recipe that gives you the weight of salt by, like, overall weight. It's very hard.
Well, yeah, but that's the other problem. So, like, if you have recipes that are written by people that have done something their whole lives, they're like, you do it till it tastes right. But that's so unhelpful to someone who's never done it, you know?
Yes, yeah. That's my mom. I mean, that's what she says. And then I'm like, ah! And so, yeah. I have my kimchi recipe, and it's all by percentage weight.
Yeah. Oh, nice. Give it to us, and we'll put... What seafood-y products do you put into it?
I use ceuchut, which is the salted shrimp. And then sometimes, you know, oysters or mussels. But my standard is ceuchut because I always have it.
Yeah. Yeah, salt by percentage. Do you think people are resistant to cooking by percentage? See, like, when I'm writing all my recipes that I have on my computer here, it's always just percentage. I just write salt as a percentage, always. You know what I mean? Like... always. But I think people don't want to calculate. I guess people don't change recipes, so they don't need to switch percentages up and down. What do they do? Like remove cabbage until it weighs exactly a kilo before they make their stuff when they're doing a recipe? It doesn't make sense, right? You know, you don't buy cabbage. You pay for cabbage by the kilo, but you buy cabbage by the cabbage. So you make the amount that is in the cabbage that you have purchased. No?
Anyway. Yeah, I assume people just do a lot of rounding.
But it's not that hard. I mean, everyone has a smart... Well, not everyone. If you are reading a recipe on the internet, you probably have a smartphone. And it just doesn't take that much time to multiply something by a percentage number. It takes almost no time.
Truth. What's this quest thing?
All right. Nastasia. So Nastasia... I spend most of my days at a desk where I am right now. It's covered in electronics because I'm prototyping. Whenever my wife comes home, she's like, "Have you cleaned up the electronics yet?" I'm like, "I'm not done with them." So it's just like I'm in piles and piles of electronics and 3D printing gear. But what Nastasia does is she deals with different teams of Amazon people. Some are bots, some are not. And she has to determine who's a bot and who's not. But she was given a task a week and a half ago. And this is relating to Nastasia and I are still trying to deal with the fact that Amazon will not sell Searsols. And we're close, people. I wouldn't say close in time, but we're close in finding out what the solution is going to be. But you want to talk about what happened there, Stas?
Quickly, they were like, you have another account underneath your, well, it's not your business name, but
we're trying to set up another selling account that's not Booker
Index.
Yeah,
you can't open this new account because there's another account that might be associated with this account, but we can't give you any other information other than this email, which is not your email. But if you look hard, you'll be able to find out like who's behind this account. And then we're going to send your business partner, Dave, a card in the mail with a special code on it. And if he gives you that code, then it'll unlock this thing so that you can figure out who's behind this other account. Because we can't tell you, but we're sure that maybe you'll be able to find out.
And by the way, this postcard is like novelty check size. It's like huge. And all it contains is like five digits of information, but it's like a novelty check that they send you in the mail. So Nastasia, I'll be you. You be the lady. Wait. So let me get this straight. You know what's wrong.
Yes.
And like looking, like you could tell exactly what it is that I need to do to rectify this.
Oh yeah.
But you won't tell me.
Right.
Because you want me to go on a quest.
Exactly. And when you find out, you call me and you tell me, and I'll let you know if it's true or not.
Whether you have fulfilled the quest. So this is like some sort of Ready Player One garbage, like where, you know, Nastasia had to go buy an Atari 2600 and she had to get like the adventure cartridge, which I used to play as a kid.
Oh, and love that game.
She had to go into all the invisible rooms and find the magic chalice and not get eaten by the dragon. And
I'm still on the quest,
Well, she would go to the lady. She'd be like, "Is it this? Do I get the magic card?" She's like,
"No."
You know what I mean? At the end, there's going to be some sort of magnificent moral lesson for you, and you'll be improved as a person, and you'll have a functional business.
That would be
so. In your mind, Nastasia, in your mind, like, who is playing the Knights Templar, and when you have to choose which cup to drink out of, and is the Nazi beat you there and drink ahead of time or not?
I don't know.
You got to choose a person now.
Oh, Harold McGee.
Harold McGee is guarding the cups?
And we're like, oh, that's Harold, so it's been you the whole time?
Yeah. Is he dressed as Zoltar at that time?
Yes.
Oh, God.
I have to say, in the Dave Arnold bingo, a reference to Indiana Jones is definitely one of the squares.
Yeah.
Although it's more and more, like, I know more and more people I've spoken to whose childhood lives were ruined by one or more of those movies. You know what I mean? So the person that we had on the show, one of the people, we had three people, one of the people we had on the show last week told me that the Temple of Doom, like, almost single-handedly ruined huge chunks of his childhood experience. Because he's Indian American. And so, like, that whole thing came out, when did it come out? Like, 1982 or 83 or something like that. So he's my age, so he was like 11 or something. And he was like, yeah, it was just like never ending garbage. Like, those movies are among the, like, if you watch them now, cringeworthy kind of situations, right? I mean, it's like, are any of them, I don't know. What are your thoughts, Peter?
Well, I have only happy feelings.
Yeah. All right. So that's the quest. And so you stay tuned next week for any kind of updates we have in the quest. If it goes much longer, we're going to try to find some sort of world famous Dungeons and Dragons expert to come on, and because Nastasia could, like, I'm gonna be the Nastasia again. Nastasia's gonna be the person she was talking to. Hey, what am I hearing? Are you rolling a 20-sided die? Because, like, she was choosing our health, right? Nastasia, like, she's rolling the die and choosing how many health points we would have. And, like, you know, so every time I hang up the phone with Nastasia at the end of the day now, I'm like, don't let the orcs get ya. Because she's in some sort of, like, weird Dungeons and Dragons kind of a situation. Oh, yeah. But, you know, before we go, who's the Nazi who chooses poorly, that, you know, Harold gets to say he chose poorly?
Oh, God, I don't know. That would be
Come
way
on.
Too personal. No, I don't know.
All right. Well, we'll let you know. We'll let you know whether we saw the crest. And Peter, congrats on the first season of your show. We're looking forward to the second one. It's good to be on. Come on. You know, you're always welcome here at the Cooking Issues. We love having you.
Thanks so much.
Yeah. All right. Cooking Issues. Cooking Issues is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening!